This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The Dalai Lama, Tibet's exiled spiritual leader, is in New York. My guest Robert Thurman is one of the people who brought him there. Thurman is the vice president of Tibet House, a nonprofit organization dedicated to preserving the culture of Tibet. Tibet's spiritual and cultural life has been under attack since the Chinese military occupation of Tibet began in 1950. To celebrate Tibetan culture and to increase awareness of the threat against it, Tibet House has organized the Year of Tibet. As part of that celebration, a series of symposiums, services, film festivals, art shows, and concerts is now underway in New York. Thurman has known the Dalai Lama for many years. Close to 30 years ago, Thurman became the first American to be ordained a Tibetan monk. Now Thurman is a professor of Indo-Tibetan Buddhist studies at Columbia University. Earlier this week, the Dalai Lama announced he would like to return to Tibet for a fact-finding mission. It would be his first visit since his exile in 1959. Robert Thurman is worried that if the Chinese government gives the Dalai Lama permission to return to Tibet, the Dalai Lama's life will be in jeopardy. I asked Robert Thurman about the significance of the Dalai Lama's wish to return.
It expresses his wish to be more Gandhian and sort of get out in the street and express the truth, stand up for the truth and put his life on the line, so to speak. And it's very moving in that sense, but very, very dangerous. Of course, because if he went there, you see, the Tibetan people would go just wild with joy. They would be frightened, but they would be very, 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 very excited, and there would be mass crowds and great demonstrations of thanksgiving and so forth. And they would be hard for him to leave again. The Chinese authorities would be very annoyed because they'd feel the Tibetans were being insubordinate. They would suppress them. It would be very, very difficult.
The Chinese invaded Tibet in 1949. The Dalai Lama has been in exile since 1959. Mm-hmm. Now, you visited Tibet in July for the first time in 4 years. Mm-hmm. How had conditions changed since your last visit?
I was very distressed. They had really gotten much worse, I thought. I mean, the land has been ruined and the monasteries destroyed for some time, and that was the same. They destroyed over 6,000 monasteries, killed 1 million people. I mean, it's a terrible story. And that, of course, was not changed. But in 87, there had been, when I was last there, 5 or 6 years of what the Chinese call liberalization. After, you know, the death of Mao and so on, China and Hu Yaobang, the man who died causing the riots in 89, about Tiananmen Square, Hu Yaobang was in power and he was trying to be more moral and more pragmatic in Tibet and let the Tibetans have a little bit of freedom, cut them a little slack. And so in 87, Tibetans were quite cheerful. They felt that things were going in a better direction, that sooner or later China would face the music and realize that Tibetans are Tibetans, basically. And their sort of long night of horror was over. They were thinking, you see, so they were quite cheerful. Then since 87, a lot of friends of the Tibetans have worked hard around the world to let the world know the story of Tibet. And then there was the liberation in Eastern Europe, the liberation in Russia, and the Dalai Lama got the Nobel Peace Prize. And we sort of thought outside that things were going in a very good direction, and it was a matter of time before Tibet joins the Baltics as one of the newly released peoples from Chinese colonialism. But then when I got to Tibet, to my shock, I saw that China is completely going in the opposite direction. They are moving Chinese nationals into Tibet to sort of smother the Tibetan population, even into central Tibet now at a great rate. There's a tremendous amount of military activity. The Tibetans on the street in the monasteries have been decimated. Their monastery numbers are way down. Their spirits are totally dampened. When I would speak to people, they would look frightened all around. Some would just run away rather than speak to me. If they would show emotion, their friends would come and try to, like, suppress it so they wouldn't attract attention. They're totally under strong intimidation and suppression, much stronger. Although China put martial law in there since 88, and then they removed it because of the most favored nation status this year, earlier. But in fact, the Tibetans say this martial law enforcers are still there. They're just in plain clothes. If you show emotion and say something about the Dalai Lama on the street to a tourist in the day, that night your house will be broken into and you'll be taken away. And that's why they were so scared.
Why has destroying the monasteries been such an important part of the Chinese campaign in Tibet?
Because China is a communist country. They believe religion is the opiate of the people. They understand that people's ideology is important in controlling how they live their lives and controlling their allegiances. So they made a systematic effort, as everyone knows, to eradicate all traces of religion in every people, in their own people, as well as in the Tibetans or any other people that they controlled. And Tibetans just completely have religion and Buddhist practice and Buddhist ideas completely embedded in their hearts and just can't get them out. And so now the Chinese then realize, then in, since the cycle in 87, where the Tibetans tried to become more outspoken, when they realized they were going to be smothered by Chinese immigration, Chinese began to realize that the monasteries were sort of a source of Tibetan national identity. That the, once they learned their Tibetan culture, they learned their Buddhism, they became more fearless in standing up against the Chinese, although that standing up was totally nonviolent. They did not have arms. They did not threaten anything. They would just go downtown and say, "We are Tibetans. Leave us alone. Please go home." And then for that, they would be shot and so on and arrested. But the monastic knowledge of sort of some sort of transcendent attitude that they would learn in the monasteries would make them much more fearless, is what they noticed. So since 88, in martial law, they have really kicked out all the more clever and intelligent young Tibetans from the monasteries.
You were a consultant on a record that recently came out of the singing and chanting of the Gyuto monks.
Right.
These are monks in exile?
Yes, these are the monks who in the rebuilt monastery, rebuilt by the Tibetan community in exile in India. There's about 250 of them in eastern India.
I'd like you to tell us a little bit about the singing. What I want to do is play just a little bit of the first recording on this album,
okay,
which was recently released by Ryko Disc. And the singing is so kind of moving and unusual to a Western ear.
Right.
Maybe before we hear it, you could tell us what it is we're hearing, because it's not a Western sound.
That's right. Well, it is something that is uniquely Tibetan. It did not come from India. It developed in Tibet with their practice of the Buddhist tantras. And the original source of it was a lama in ancient, about 500-600 years ago, who, in a deep state of meditation, confronted death, actually, confronted sort of all the difficulties in the universe, especially the god of death, according to the myth. And in that moment of confrontation, he just felt spontaneously this sound emerged from him, a kind of chant, sort of saying, you know, death shall be no more, you know, enlightenment shall triumph over death, love and enlightenment shall triumph over death. And he sort of made this chant, sort of facing down the negative aspect of reality and insisting upon positiveness in that aspect. And this then became, this was such an extraordinary chant that he made, everyone was so moved by it. It became, the monastery began to learn it, and he communicated what was originally this vision and made a sort of discipline out of it. And those monks had this particular very deep voice that is considered to resonate in such a way that its sound reaches to the underworld and to the heavens as well as to the earth.
Let's hear some of the chanting of the Gyuto monks. Robert Thurman, can you give us any insights into how that is done physically?
Yes. Physically, they develop an openness in the throat and diaphragm area of great relaxation, actually. And they, by contemplating that they are a vessel of this sound of wisdom coming through them, that they are not as an ego entity making the sound, if you follow me. And then by generating that great relaxation and openness, when they sound a deep note, the vocal cord, the other vocal cords, and the opened cavity in which the vocal cords reside are such that the higher resonances occur. So their computers have picked apart two or three octaves above the bass note, a resonating note, like with a sitar, you know, or a guitar. When you play one string, the other strings will resonate sympathetically.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the same as that. That's how they do it. But the curious thing is that people, when they try to learn it as just a sort of physical thing, of like, I'm going to do this exercise or that, they have a great difficulty doing it. It does involve a certain insight where you open to the universe in a way where you don't feel that you're putting your voice out there. You're sort of pushing the sound out as an ego. You open up into the realization of selflessness, and then you let the sound come through. That's the only way to achieve the kind of physical relaxation that they require.
By the way, the album that features the music that we just heard is called the Gyuto Monks Freedom Chants from the Roof of the World, and the monks are actually on a performance tour of America. My guest is Robert Thurman. He was a consultant to the record we just heard. He's a vice president of Tibet House in Manhattan, which is dedicated to saving Tibetan culture. And this is the group that organized the Year of Tibet and brought the Dalai Lama to the United States. We're going to take a short break and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Robert Thurman is my guest. He's a professor of Indo-Tibetan Buddhist Studies at Columbia University. The Tibetan Buddhists have a philosophy that everything is impermanent. The religion of Buddhism itself is threatened in Tibet.
Right.
So what kind of position does that leave the Tibetan monks in? Do they accept the impermanence of their own religion and therefore not fight against those who would destroy the religion?
Yes, they don't fight violently, but not only because of impermanence. They don't fight violently because they don't believe in violence. They feel that the continuity of the soul go through love and wisdom goes on better without violence. And even if they die physically, they'll be reborn in another body, and that body will be better for their not having been violent. So that's the reason they don't fight. They do fight in a sense of they stand up to speak out that religion should not be destroyed, people should be free to practice religion, people should not harm each other, and they are willing to put their lives on the line behind that principle. But not violently. It's a unique thing, the Tibetans. People haven't recognized the Tibetans' desire for freedom because the Tibetans have not gone into terrorism or gone into a violent revolution. But they don't realize that by the Tibetans, by going downtown in Lhasa and saying, we are a free country, we are Tibetans, and getting shot for that, that is like a way of fighting for them.
Tibetan exiles in India recently demonstrated, mm-hmm. and they were chanting, Tibet is China's Kuwait.
Mm-hmm.
And the Tibetan Youth Congress, which organized the demonstration, urged President Bush to force China to leave Tibet. Now, mm-hmm. as a nonviolent culture, exactly mm-hmm. what do the Tibetans want Bush to do?
Well, the Tibetan, to say a nonviolent culture does not mean, of course, that every Tibetan is enlightened and capable. It's not an easy achievement to really be nonviolent. And some of the young people are constantly straining against the basic philosophy of the culture, which is that we should maintain nonviolence. However, so far they have followed the leadership of the Dalai Lama and the monks and Buddhism to the extent that there has been no serious act of Tibetan terrorism in the world. You can't find one over the last 40 years, even though they've been ignored and the world has turned their backs to the Tibetans. So while they tend to be a little fiery in their demands sometimes, the Tibetan youth, they so far have not gone over that line into some sort of terrorist act to attract attention. What they want Bush to do by forcing is they want to see economic sanctions. They want to see the U.S. apply a policy it has applied to South Africa and to the Soviet Union against the tyranny in China. They want to see fairness and justice applied to them as it was applied to Kuwait or to other countries, the Baltics and so forth, that have in fact achieved liberation recently. They do not want, and the Dalai Lama actually refused an offer from President Truman many years ago, sort of violent intervention or, you know, invasion or something like that. That is out of the question, and they have never asked for that.
How is the practice of Buddhism in Tibet changing since the Chinese have tried so hard to suppress any expressions of it?
Well, it's changed in that relatively fewer people have been allowed to practice it. Parents who are particularly religious and want their children, sons or daughters, to grow up relearning Buddhism more strictly have smuggled them out into India to learn in the free monasteries in Nepal and India. So it's been greatly restricted. And His Holiness the Dalai Lama has told me that some monks who escaped to India and joined the Tibetan monasteries in India set a certain example of intensity and integrity for the monks in India because they grew up under such suffering. They're very, very intent on their religious development. And so I think that there could be a great renewal from this long night of suffering that the Tibetans have had. if things go well in the final analysis, which I'm sure they will, I'm sure freedom will prevail, and then there will be a great intensification of Tibetan Buddhism, I believe, in Tibet. The Dalai Lama often says so. He says he personally benefited by having lost the country and having suffered the great suffering of that loss and being free also of the protocol and a lot of the routines having to do with the Tibetan conventions. He feels he profited in that he was forced to study more intensely, and he feels he learned, he used his teachings better. He likes to say that, and I think he considers that a fact.
We've been hearing a lot about the Dalai Lama this week since he's visiting the United States. I think most of us in America don't really understand what it means to be the Dalai Lama.
That's for sure. I don't think many people anywhere do. The Dalai Lama is considered a reincarnation of the archangel of compassion in the Tibetan view, or the Buddha of compassion, you could say. And in that sense, is almost a superhuman being. But on the other hand, as a reincarnation, he is one who has taken flesh in the human form. So he's a combination human-superhuman. And it gives him a very grave responsibility. He's found as a small child, and then he's trained in a special way and highly educated. Just because he's a reincarnation, that doesn't mean that he should just be put on a throne and worshipped. He's given an intense education and eventually becomes the teacher of his people. The other unique aspect of it was that it's the one country in the Buddhist world where a monk is put as the ruler of the country, which is quite extraordinary in the Buddhist world. Usually there's a king, a secular ruler, and then there's a monk who runs the monasteries. But in the case of Tibet, they did away with the king, the secular king, after a while, because all of Tibetans became so preoccupied with Buddhist practice that the country really became a sacralized country, you could say.
So if the Dalai Lama is found when he is very young, how is this Dalai Lama found?
Well, there's a number, they use a lot of different techniques. The Dalai Lama's attendants in his previous life remember various clues that the Dalai Lama gives. He says, well, he likes a certain area, or he enjoyed a certain place or some people. He says, I think I'll be born in this area or that. He leaves certain hints, and they collect and compare all the different hints. Then after he passes away, they consult oracles. They have sort of channels, what we would call channels, I think, nowadays. And then they have psychics, people who are professionally trained clairvoyants, and they consult those. And then there's a special lake high in Tibet, about 17,500 feet, which is considered a magic mirror lake, where when you go and perform certain ceremonies to the goddess who is considered the protectress of Tibet, she then reveals a vision of in the lake that will give the search party a clue into where to find the Dalai Lama.
You run into a real problem with this, don't you? I mean, it doesn't really translate that well in the West. What? Doesn't it sound to the Western ear like a lot of magic and hocus pocus and everything?
Yeah. Oh, certainly. That's because, of course, Westerners do not believe in the future life. And they think that everyone is just the body and mind of this life, and when you die, that's it for you type of thing. You know, I mean, that's our general worldview. Whereas in Tibet, as in many countries in the East, the idea of a continuity of the soul is very, very accepted. And then they have on top of that the very strange idea that a person who develops great mastery of the mind and what's called the subtle mind can practice or rehearse the process of death, where they can withdraw from their coarse senses, you know, their ordinary outside five senses, and that they can go into sort of states of various states, like dreamlike type of state. They believe a person like that after death can actually direct where they go and how they're reborn and whose family they live in and what country and so on.
On your last trip to Tibet, how had the proportion of Chinese to Tibetan culture changed? Did you notice any differences?
Oh, enormously. Well, in two ways. Lhasa itself, even in 4 years, the number of Chinese has increased hugely. Lhasa, which is the capital of Tibet, is about one quarter Tibetan now. When I was there in 87, it might have been one-third Tibetan, let's say, or nearly a half. But now it's one quarter Tibetan, and the vast majority of people there are Chinese, and they're building condominiums and apartment buildings and just building like crazy with all Chinese laborers, and all unemployed Tibetans, but bringing in Chinese laborers to do it. And military barracks have sprung up all over the place, so the Chinese, you know, population pressure there is intensified to an extreme degree. In other cities, it's the same story. And in the highlands, the flat highlands, where basically you can really only live by herding animals, still the Tibetans are roaming there, and they're still very sparse and empty, but they've concentrated very strongly in the cities. Then in this trip, I went to eastern Tibet, and I drove all through eastern Tibet on a sort of quick trip just to take a look at it. And that's where the biggest concentration of Chinese population is, in eastern Tibet. In states, the Chinese actually carved off states that they call by different names. They don't call it Tibet, but it is originally Tibet, Qinghai and Sichuan. And there I saw a total swamping of the Tibetans by the Chinese.
What would it mean to the rest of the world if Tibetan culture and religion and art were lost?
It would be an irretrievable loss, I feel, in this following sense. It isn't just that it's a loss if any culture or any single human being is lost. You know, we all lose something when anything is lost. So in general, that is the loss. But in particular, in the case of Tibet, Tibet is the conservator of a very ancient wisdom, art, and religion that reached its flowering in India in the second half of the first millennium of the Common Era, from 500 AD to 1000 AD approximately. And this was there were like 30 libraries of Alexandria there. I like to use that example, you know, like the Egyptian one that was destroyed. There were 30 of them in India at that time, with fantastic psychology and depth psychology and philosophy and vast numbers of treatises written in Sanskrit and musical things and architecture. I mean, whatever, you name it, medicine, ancient and very marvelous healing traditions. And this was translated over 400 or 500 years into Tibet. And the Tibetans turned their whole national life over to it, body and soul, and they became practitioners, developers, and also conservators of this wonderful ancient wisdom, which is one of the great treasures of the world. And so Tibet was saved that through all the great, you know, the Mongol invasions, the Muslim invasions of the second millennium, and all of the European invasions and destructions of many things, and they've saved that until modern time. And now we're in this modern time where sort of we're becoming planet Earth, you know, and everyone is interconnected, and each ethnicity contributes its specific facet to the jewel of human being, you know. And the Tibetans have kept this wonderful old treasure that has a special value. And if their culture is destroyed, that is really then lost forever. And that would be a great shame.
Robert Thurman, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much, Terry. I enjoyed it.
Robert Thurman is the vice president of Tibet House in Manhattan, which organized the International Year of Tibet. Thurman is also a professor of Indo-Tibetan Buddhism at Columbia University. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.